Actually, I might hit up Mark Nestico. Do you know Nestico?
I know of him.
So he actually might be kind of interesting to shoot the shit with, and he's a big nerd.
Yeah.
So you good? I'll hit him up.
Yeah, let me get a drink real quick.
I'm not saying he's gonna come on like in the next 30 seconds, but go get your drink. Like, this is your first day fucking podcasting? Fuck.
No, I mean I got my water, but I was like, maybe I'll have a beer. I'm gonna get a beer.
Oh no, don't succumb to peer pressure yet. We'll see where tonight takes us.
Succumb to peer? What do you mean?
You say you don't drink anymore.
I bought beer today.
Why?
I don't know. I felt like drinking.
If you're gonna drink, I'm gonna drink then.
All right, let's do it.
Welcome to the WWSD podcast. Weekly, we share discussions with interesting and creative people. We are sponsored by Collector's Maze. You can check them out at collectorsmaze.com for all things related to Phantom. I'm your host, Josh, and as always, I'm joined by my buddy, Seamus. How's it going, Seamus?
It's going awesome, man. How are you doing?
I'm doing well.
Awesome. Who do we have on tonight?
This week, we are joined with friend of the podcast, Mark Nestico. Mark does the resale and buying of collectibles such as trading cards and retro video games. He's a really interesting guy. He's done a lot of writing in the past for various websites such as Star City Games, TCG Player, and Channel Fireball.
Appreciate you coming on, Mark.
Thank you.
And then right now you're just doing the full-time selling, right?
Yep. Selling and buying and a video game business.
What are you doing with your video game business?
He buys retro stuff.
Oh, cool, man. Like old school shit?
Old school shit, new school shit, just everything. I mean, it all makes money, so I just buy it all.
What's like the white whale of like video game collecting right now?
If you're like a serious collector, a Nintendo Gold cart, which is like a world championship cart, that's like up there in terms of the scarcity and prestige.
Which system is that for?
Nintendo.
Like NES. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, I don't know how many copies there are. I think it's a few hundred. Okay. Because they were only given out to world champions and shit like that. So
what do they have on them?
It has Super Mario World and Track, and I want to say Rad Racer. I might be wrong though. Let me check.
What's the price point on that?
Oh, a lot.
Like five figures, six figures, a lot.
Five figures.
Okay. Yeah, I'm pretty sure most of them are either destroyed or like they're in a very limited number of collectors' hands.
Are there any like collectible games like past N64? You know, do the collectibles really like go off after that point?
Oh yeah, no, there's a ton of rare price point games. PS2 has quite a few. GameCube has several, not like the insanely expensive games, but like, you know, talking like $3,000, $5,000, like right around like that market. Like Wii has a couple, PS3 has a few.
What makes those games rare? It is limited runs, or they got canceled, or
mostly they just didn't have an audience. So
okay, so like Barbie Dreamhouse 4 or something like that.
Yeah, it's okay. Funny enough, like it is some games like that, but a lot of like the horror games, which have a very select audience for like PlayStation 2, for example. Like some of the Silent Hill games are like a very easy example because they're some of them are like in the 100 to 200 range, but it's mostly like horror games and things like that really captivate people on a cult level.
Okay. I know like around the PS2 time they started doing like steelbook editions, and they started having like the collector's editions of stuff. Are like those valuable per se, or
not? No. Really.
Okay.
No. Yeah, I figured.
That's awesome.
What are some of the more rare like consoles that people look for?
Atari Jaguar.
Okay.
Is one. There's a calculator one. I'm trying to remember the name of, like T180. Let me look at that real quick. It's a Texas Instrument game. TurboGrafx is like a cult system. It didn't sell very well, but it has incredible graphics for its time, and it has a really, really good library. Those are like the good ones, you know, that people know about, but are still pretty rare and hard to find.
I remember I set up like a Raspberry Pi with all of those systems on it recently. That was pretty cool. Like,
oh yeah,
like it has you can put everything on it.
So does that affect like the retro game market at all with the Raspberry Pis, because they're becoming more popular to build your own systems and shit?
No, people want to have like tangibility. They want to actually like have the game in their hands. They want to display it, collect it, be able to play it like they did when they were a kid, sort of relive that nostalgia. So what you'll usually see with like Nintendo or Super Nintendo, Sega Genesis, PlayStation 1, N64, people really want those games, you know, in their hands so they can sort of just have that connection to them that they had when they were younger.
Okay. Yeah. The emulators for like N64 and PlayStation 1 and like beyond that aren't really that great anyway. There's a lot of lag and things like that. There's a lot of issues with it.
Yeah. There's nothing like the original. So it's, you know, when you hear that PlayStation 1 boot up screen.
Yeah. I think some of those hardware things are hard to emulate. I think that's what the problem is.
Also, the code's probably lost or ancient. I know they lost code for a lot of that kind of stuff. Like it just disappears.
Yeah, like PlayStation Store doesn't have a lot of games on it from like the PS1, PS2 era because they just don't have the rights to them or they don't have the ability to display them. So
it's such an interesting market and all because like there's like probably two groups of people. There are people that really want to collect like games in box that never been touched before, and people that just want to get old games so they can play them again and like relive their childhood.
Yeah, there's definitely a collector's market. Those are people usually with like deeper pockets or people that wheel and deal pretty heavily. And they sort of make that their like not like just their hobby, but like more of like a pursuit, like a life's pursuit. But the collectors in that regard are definitely into the more expensive things, the completionists. But the normal people like me, like I just want what games I had when I was a kid. I want to enjoy those games and then I don't really, you know, I sell the rest.
So after you enjoy those games, you just resell it or you just kind of keep it in your collection?
No, I keep them. Okay. I have a pretty large collection of stuff that I just want to always keep and share with my son when he gets older. And
yeah,
even though a lot of them are rated M for mature, so I don't need my 7-year-old son playing Manhunt.
Like it's a little bit older. Yeah.
Do you play those on the original consoles or do you have any of those those hybrid ones that they've come out with?
Original consoles.
I find for like NES, some of those new top loader ones that they've made it like kind of work a little bit better, you know, because it's not as wonky.
You can get they have HDMI as well on them, so you do get a better picture. Like if you have an old style CRTV, like the tube TVs, you can play them like in a very like normal fashion. Graphics are good. It's very nostalgic. But if you're trying to play it on like your 70-inch 4K UHD, like it's going to look weird.
Yeah, I guess because that makes sense as well. Because like no one had those TVs back then.
No, you got to buy the old one. Got to go to a Goodwill.
So I guess is that also another thing? Is like just collecting like really good like old school TVs.
It's not like a huge thing, but you definitely want to have one. And it's pretty funny because you could just go like flea marketing or garage sailing one weekend, and people will just give you the TVs that they have, or estate sales with old people that are dead that never replaced their TVs from like the 80s. So you can get those for like $5. So it's a little. Nice little tip for those of you out there that are getting into retro gaming.
What's your gem in your collection?
For me personally, it's not even like it's not a super rare game, but it's called Jade Cocoon 2. It's my favorite game of all time. It's like that would be my gem. It's a PlayStation 2 title. It's a ton of fun. The graphics were incredible for the time. They still stand up, and it's just that's my baby. That's the one that I pull out once a year and play and just enjoy myself.
What's the gameplay like with that?
It's an RPG. When Jade Cocoon came out, it kind of came out around the same time as Pokemon, and they have very similar themes, like catching beasts and purifying them and combining them. That was sort of like the cool thing that you could do in that game. It was very anime inspired, and then the sequel drew from that, but it was more like in depth and a much better story, much better graphics, and it was very, very deep. And it's an awesome game if you haven't played it.
Now, when you were younger, were you the kind of kid that used to go to like the Hollywood videos and the Blockbusters and rent video games?
Oh, yeah.
Because I miss that more than anything.
Oh, like, my God. My wife and I used to go on dates to when we were young. That's like our thing. We'd go to Blockbuster and like pick up cheap Chinese food and rent a movie. And that was like our date. And I mean, I really miss that. That was the best time.
Yeah, it was like pre-internet where you just had to look at box art and like, is this cool? Like,
oh, yeah. You had to like read the back.
Yeah, even with the movies. Yeah, I remember watching so many terrible movies just because the box art looked dope as fuck.
Oh, yeah. You were playing a lot of shitty games because you were right? You know, this is it, man. This game has got sweet box art and it was just absolute dildos. So
I love the juxtaposition of like the old NES like game, like the game boxes. And then like you go and play. And I mean, it's
trash.
You know, yeah, it's two-dimensional sprite shit.
Yeah, that was like the Atari thing. Like Atari had some of the best box art ever. Like their box arts were works of art. But then you would like play it and it's like this like 4-bit, you know, like squares and, you know, just little lines moving back and forth.
Like fucking Spider-Man.
Yeah, the art was like almost like movie poster esque.
Oh, it was gorgeous.
Like cartridge, like on the cartridge art and all. Like, they were awesome.
Oh, I loved it.
And they look nothing like the actual game.
Not even remotely close. No. Yeah.
The thing I like about like retro games too is that it's like you're kind of exploring like, you know, unexplored territory sometimes, because there were so many like indie titles and so many like different weird things that were happening, because like people really hadn't figured it out yet.
Yeah, NES was really good at that. If you ever played the original Nintendo, there are, I think it's like 700 plus titles, maybe closer to 800. And the library is so expansive, and like probably 70% of it is shit, but 30% that's not is like incredible. Like the games like Little Samson and things like that, which came out late in the system's life, are just incredible games that they never got anybody to play them. So now they're like $1,000-$2,000 games, but it's definitely worth like getting a chance to play some of those games, because they were just the diversity in the console was incredible.
I guess that's also a good thing about the emulation, is just the people that want to just play it, they have the opportunity to play those games, because if not, those would be lost in time. Because like how often do you really, I mean, besides you, like as like a game fan, like I would never go back and play like a Nintendo game. Like it just, unless it's like for nostalgia or something.
Yeah, I agree with you. There are all-in-one carts that you can buy like for your Nintendo that have every single game on them, and you can just play them and enjoy them. And there are some very elitist collectors that are like, can't believe you would do that. Like you're ruining the hobby. And I'm like, fuck you. Like, you know, if so-and-so wants to spend $60 to like relive playing Power Blade, like let him do it. Like who gives a shit if he doesn't want to spend $150 on the real one?
It's not just that, because you also need the console, you need the old school TV. It's just like,
yeah, it's such a pain in the ass.
They've got that for like N64 too, where you can it's got like an SD card insert, and it's a cartridge that you can put into the old system.
Yeah,
exactly. You can play any game. Yeah, it's pretty sweet.
Yeah, because there's a lot of games that's like you'll never be able to find, like realistically, like there's just so limited copies, like you can never just go and buy them all. I know people bitch about that, like piracy and stuff like that. Like those older, they don't put those on like the Nintendo Switch and stuff like that. Like those old games. So like once they're gone, like you can never really realistically replay them like on current hardware.
Yeah, a lot of them were third party too, mm-hmm. So you don't have the rights to them anymore. So you can't do that. So that is the dagger for retro gaming collection. So it's basically like I don't want to call it an all or nothing hobby, but you have to be very invested in it. You have to work Facebook Marketplace, Mercari, OfferUp, you know, Twitter, Instagram. You have to work every sort of angle to get what you want in terms of completing your collection, or making it at least what you want out of it.
Is there like a TCG type marketplace where you can just go buy a bunch of games if I wanted to, or not really?
eBay is the closest thing you're going to get to it.
How do you kind of like track market movements for these collectibles?
Price charting is the website that sort of leads the way in that. And also eBay comps are king. Unfortunately, you know, it's one of those things where like the games fluctuate so much, but they're always going up because the scarcity is continuing to, you know, these games are getting lost of time. So you see a lot of people that are like, oh, this game went for 90 on eBay. Like I'll sell it to you for 90. And there's very little wiggle room in regards to people making deals, because eBay and price charting sort of run, they're like the rule of the roost. So
you as like a reseller, are you able to get those at a kind of like wholesale cost so you can resell them, or do you have to buy them at the real cost and then like wait until they go up?
You probably buy collections, I would imagine, right? Where people just try to sell like everything.
Yeah, you buy collections because number one, like people, they don't want to do the work. Like that is one of the most, that's probably the easiest way to get a collection number is because people don't want to, you know, I just bought a massive collection and the guy was like, I know what I have, I know what it's worth, but I don't want to spend 15 hours on eBay listing it all. I don't want to spend, five hours shipping it all. I don't want to pay shipping costs. I don't want to pay taxes on it because it's over $5,000. I don't want to pay eBay fees. It's like, you can just do all the work and buy it at like 60%. So you'll make, you know, your 20%. But then you'll also, you know, you're going to have to pay the taxes. You're going to have to do all the work. You're going to have to, you know, take the eBay fee hit. So it works out.
Is 20% kind of the margin you shoot for?
50, like there are certain things like 3DS handhelds I buy for like 70% of their value because the turnaround on them is super great.
It's quick. Yeah.
Yeah. So like they never sit. You can buy them and
I'm sure like Pokemon games are the same thing, right? Where it is constantly off the shelf. Yeah.
Yeah. Pokemon games are bangers. I just buy them. I buy like a 3DS XL for $140. I'll put it up for $165, $170. It'll sell. I'll just package it, make my $10-$15 and just, you know, do that over and over and over again. So that's the plan.
And even with collection buying, like I'm sure they go through and they pull out like the Golden Eyes and like the Zeldas, like the bangers that they know they're like this everyone loves. But like it's probably like those rare gems, like the Barbie Dreamhouse 4s that they'll never pull out and like price down. Those are the ones that are probably worth a lot of money.
Sometimes, but the thing that gets me the business that it's gotten me is I'm extremely transparent with people and I am very, very astute on my pricing because a lot of my business is done through the internet and it's come from word of mouth. You know, a lot of people message me saying they want to sell because I give really fair prices and that's sort of the idea. So if a guy's collection is worth $1,000, I'll pay him like $750. And after everything's all said and done, I'll make, you know, $875, but I just keep repeating that because of how many people were selling to me. So it ends up being a fantastic business for me, but it's a lot of work and it takes a lot of time. And, you know, you're putting in 8 hours a day, every day, 7 days a week, you're answering DMs constantly.
Probably more than 8 hours days. Yeah.
Yeah. It's, you know, it never stops. I tell people I set my alarm in the morning. I set my alarm for 2 o'clock in the morning, 4 o'clock in the morning, 6 o'clock in the morning, and 8 o'clock in the morning because I wake up every 2 hours to check my DMs, answer people, get deals rolling. And that's just how I have to do it because you have to stay on top of it or they'll sell to someone else.
Do you enjoy what you're doing?
Oh my God. I used to serve tables I went to college, but you make so much more money serving tables than where we live in Florida.
Yeah, because you live out in Naples and also, yeah, those restaurants.
It's pretty unreal. So I did that for years. I did fine dining. I did management. I did training. You know, I did the whole thing. And I make a lot more money doing this and I'm a lot happier. So it's definitely a delight.
Seems like a cool thing to be able to just like you're always interacting with the stuff that you love and, you know, and you get to say your own thing. You're in control of it. There's probably a direct relationship to how much work you put into what you make. And
yeah, I never stop. My wife has to remind me to take like an hour or two to just stop or, you know, turn my phone off at 8 or 9 o'clock, which I never do. But, you know, I fuck that shit. But it's one of those things where like the money it's always there and you just have to do the work to get it. And if you buy better than everybody else does and you turn and burn, you're going to make smaller margins, but you're going to make it faster and you'll make just as much as they do. But you'll work harder than they do, but at the same time, it's good for your bankroll. It's good for
You're constantly have money coming in, and
you're constantly you're very liquid, so it's good in that regard. Very good.
Now, when you're buying like stuff, do you have like anything you need to stay away from, like with retro stuff, like just like I'm not dealing with this.
I don't fuck with Xbox original or 360. Those games, A, they really suck, and B, they were mass produced. Okay. So like the good games for the system, like your Halos and things like that, you don't make any money on. They're worth like, you know, pennies on the dollar.
Those are all available on all the marketplaces. You can download them for PC and shit like that.
Yeah. Probably. And there's like 700 of them. There's like Halo 1, 2, 3, 4, this Halo, that Halo. So, I mean, it's like that Gears of War. There's some games for Xbox that I'll buy, like, you know, like Conkers is a good example of one, or the Silent Hill games for the Xbox systems. But other than that, I just stay away.
You ever get like super burnt on something like a purchase for retro stuff or everything you've done pretty well? Yeah.
Oh yeah. I bought this guy's large Pokemon collection and this is my fault. I was so busy at the time that I paid the guy. I got the box, looked into it. I was like, yep, it's all here. Paid the guy. And then I looked through everything. I was like, oh shit. Like 90% of these Pokemon games are fake. And I paid it was like probably $1,200 in games. And I paid the guy like $850.
How do people fake games? Is it a cartridge that works? It's just not. It's like aftermarket.
Exactly. It's like produced in Taiwan. You know, it's one of those like, if you really look at it, you can tell it's fake. But I was so busy at the time, like I was putting in 10-hour days, 7 days a week for 3 months, and I just was like, yeah, sure, it's fine, it's fine, it's fine, it's fine. And the guy blocked me because then he knew,
of course,
like, he knew he got over on me, and you know it. And you pay for your education sometimes. It is what it is. And it's like with all hobbies, like you learn a lesson and you move on.
Now, is there any market?
Yeah. They, I mean, I didn't make my money back, but I like you could sell.
Well, you didn't like eat it.
No, you could sell Pokemon Emerald like a fake copy for like $20, but that's not the $100 that it goes for. So
is it really $100?
Oh, no. So when COVID was at its peak, handhelds were ridiculous and Pokemon Emerald was going for $190.
Oh, wow.
Now it's back down to like between $80 and $110.
That's crazy.
Yes, I made a lot of money.
Did all the video games spike like during that time?
Oh, yeah.
Everything spiked. Anything collectible spiked.
Huge.
I think markets in general spiked. I think the inflation of the money probably had something to do with it. Like because we printed all that money and then like.
So during COVID, were you working in the restaurant during COVID or did you quit right before COVID?
I started, but that was when I started my selling card business with my partner and the video game business. So it was October of 2020 that I quit because I was like, I'm making so much more than I make serving that serving was detracting from what I was doing.
You're losing money serving.
You know, I was checking my phone while I was serving and I was like, oh, cool. I just made $300. I just did this deal. Like, how badass is that? And I was like working for, you know, and it was COVID. So weren't busy. And it was like, you know, I'd come home and I made $50 and I'm like, if I just stayed home, like I could have focused all my attention on this. And, you know, I could have had like a $500 day, which would be pretty badass.
Yeah, you have to roll silverware, you have to stand on your feet the entire time.
Exactly. So it was one of those situations where my wife knew I was unhappy and she goes like, I'll go on this adventure with you. Like, give it a shot. If it doesn't work, you can always go back to serving. But if it does work, you know, we'll be better off financially and we'll be a lot happier. So I took the plunge.
Yeah. And I know you've been killing it with on Twitter with selling the magic stuff and all that. I didn't realize you're also selling video games on Twitter. It's pretty neat too.
Yep.
Like is it kind of the same type of like deals? Like people are just coming to you for stuff or you're posting like lots of video games. Like how do you actually sell video games on Twitter?
The video games I buy on Twitter and I sell them on eBay.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So, but occasionally like somebody will message me and be like, hey, do you have Pokemon Platinum? And I'll be like, yeah. And so I'll bro price them. You know, the game goes for $100. I'll be like, well, I bought it for $70, but I'll sell it to you for $85.
Yeah.
You know, so I can give them the benefit of like, because after eBay fees and everything comes out in taxes, I mean, it's one of those.
Yeah, you're losing that anyway.
Where like you're just like, well, I'm gonna make $15 off this anyway, so I'll just sell it to them for that, and then they get happy and they tell their friends, and you know, it leads to more business opportunities, more people selling video games to you. And so that's where the video game business sort of began flourishing.
Now, I know you said the handhelds sell pretty well. Is any handheld in particular, or it just doesn't matter? All the handhelds are good.
All Nintendo handhelds, except for like the original Game Boy brick, but like Game Boy Pockets, Game Boy Colors, Game Boy Advances, Game Boy SPs, Nintendo 3DSs, 3DS XLs, new Nintendo 3DS XLs. They sell really, really well.
Do you deal with any like more of the esoteric consoles?
Like what?
I don't have anything. You know, just like I don't know. There were a few like there were some that didn't do so well. Like
it's like a Dreamcast type stuff.
Yeah,
like limited game libraries.
There's that, or there was that one that there's another one that came out like in the mid 90s. It was a flop. And I wonder if there's like a collector's market for that kind of stuff.
Oh yeah. 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 Like there's like Sega CD, for example, didn't do extremely well, but there is a very big market for the niche market has some big deep pockets for those people. Like Lynx is another one. 3DO.
That's the one I was thinking of. 3DO.
Yeah. 3DO is one of those situations where the market is very small, but those people are ravenous. So if you get rare 3DO games, they'll throw money at you.
That's cool. Are you still playing Magic?
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. I'm a fiend for EDH.
So the actual Magic selling though, I know you mentioned you had a business partner that you guys sell Magic. You want to go into that a bit?
Yeah, I partnered with a friend of mine who runs the Sword Next Ridge Games in Tampa. Yeah. And we call ourselves the Tom Band Squad. The guy hates us. But I hope, if you're listening, I love you. But we started, you know, it started as a joke, basically. He just messaged me and was like, hey, man, do you want to sell some cards? I had like 5,000 Twitter followers from this thing that I did called Serving Sucks, which was where I would tell serving stories and people really thought it was funny.
And that's a play on your Magic articles, right?
Yeah, it was my Magic articles were why your deck sucks.
Yeah.
And that was like my niche that I carved out. But he just messaged me. He's like, hey, man, do you want to sell some Magic cards, make a few bucks? I was like, sure. So we sold some Magic cards, and you know, it was very little. It was like $300 in cards, but they sold in like 10 minutes. And we were like, well, this is fucking sweet. Like, I wonder what more we could do with this. So we posted a few higher end items and they sold like super quick. And we were like, okay, you know, lightning strikes once. Okay. Lightning strikes twice. That's maybe there's something there. So we decided to do a full weekend where we would post all of his inventory, which was not very much because, you know, COVID was just starting. And what are you going to do? Like, people aren't coming into your store. There's nobody. There's no influx of cards. There's no outflux of cards either, because you can only sell so much on TCG Player before your well runs dry. And we did extremely well that weekend, and extremely well by those metrics for what we were doing, you know, like a year and a half ago, what we thought was really well. So we, you know, started talking and we were like, okay, like let's see what happens if we start buying collections now, since we actually had some extra money. People started going like, okay, we'll sell to you. So we started buying collections, and they started going from like $400 collections to like $1,000 collections, to like $10,000 collections, to $110,000 collections. We basically started noticing over the course of about, and this was all like within a 3 month time frame. Like, we started in May, and by August, I guess, yeah, it would probably be about August, we sort of caught fire. And people started messaging me and were like, hey, man, I need these cards. Like, hey, I saw them on your website. Like, can I buy them off you? And things like that. And we just kind of were like, okay, shit, we need to start going like balls deep in this now. Like, we can't just, this isn't a gimmick anymore. Like, this isn't a way to make an extra, you know, $1,000 a month. Like, this is something more there.
This is the business.
This is a business. We just kind of went with it. And by October, we had bought about $500,000 worth of collections, and we had made quite a bit, not a ton more than that, because we actually buy for insane prices. That's why we're so successful. You know, your local LGSs, they buy for like 40, 50% of market, whereas we buy for a much higher percentage than that. And we don't ding for condition as badly as some stores and some like the big boxes do. Like, you'll look on Star City and they'll buy an Underground C for $500, but what they don't tell you is if it's an HPC, they buy it for like $200. Yeah. You know, so like, we don't ding as bad on condition as they do, because we're taking those cards and we'll buy that Underground C that's HP, you know, that's worth $475, and we'll sell it for, you know, we'll buy it for $375 and sell it for $475 and make our little profit on it and just get it out the door. So that way it's people are paying less than they would pay on TCG Player. We're not taking TCG Player hits, so the liquidity is insane. And at the same time, we are building goodwill with people, because the prices that we're giving them are just bananas. And they're telling their friends, they're retweeting my statuses. And it just, at this point now, it's taken on a life of its own.
So you guys have an online marketplace?
We have a website, nextridgegames.com. We sell on TCG Player under Next Ridge Games. A large bulk of our sales is done through my Twitter.
How much does like the condition of the card affect the resale value if it's a card that's used in like tournaments, like quite a bit, because people are playing it in tournaments rather than just than it has any other kind of value, you know?
Realistically, it comes down to how much the card is played. If a card, let's say it's in near mint condition, it's worth $100. In light played condition, it's worth $90. In MP condition, it's worth $80. And in heavily played condition, it's worth $60 or $70, or right, something around that frame. The importance of the card will sort of dictate if it's bought at a certain pace or not. So if a card is heavily played, like the most popular format in Magic is called EDH. It's Elder Dragon Highlander, or Commander, as it's now called. And it's a format of your deck only plays one of. So it only plays, for your listeners that don't know what Commander is, your deck only plays one of each card.
Most of our listeners aren't Magic players. This is funny.
Okay. So it's a very, very popular format. And there are cards that are worth hundreds, thousands of dollars strictly because Commander is the most popular format in Magic. So cards that used to be worth like $10, $15, like 10 years ago, are now worth like $250, $300, $900, $1,000, because they make your deck better. So in EDH, a card's condition doesn't quote unquote matter, because the power level of the card is what dictates if you want it in your deck or not. But even like, for example, there's a card called Grim Monolith, where a near mint copy of it is worth around between $280 and $325. That's depending on the market flux. An HP copy you can get for like $220. But people will still pay the $220 very, very easily because the card itself is so powerful, not crucial, but beneficial to your deck, that they will pay that much money. It's pretty cool. Like it's a very unique market for trading cards compared to other trading card games.
What do you think is the most notable notable jump in price just from EDH for one of those cards?
That's a great question. There are niche cards.
Like Smothering Tithe would be probably a good example of like,
yes, Smothering Tithe for like accessibility for like the normal player getting it. It was a card that when it first came out, it was $5. Now it's like worth $40. Yeah.
It was in a pre-con as well.
Like yeah.
It's standard. Yeah. It was a standard set.
It's a really good card. There are other cards. Like for example, there's a card called The Abyss, which 5-6 years ago used to be worth $300, but like certain commander decks like really benefit from playing it. Now it's like $1,000 card. Gaia's Cradle used to be like an $80 card 10 years ago. And now it's, you know, in near mint condition, it's worth like $900. There has been a metric growth in some of these more, you know, rare, more prestigious cards.
Yeah. Over like with the pandemic and all like this, everyone was going crazy for every collectible and like cards just shot up. Like my EDH deck, my main one was like a $5,000 deck and it jumped to like 11,000, like yep. over like that course of time. And it's just like, none of these cards like became more rare. Like none of them like became better. It's just the scarcity. People wanted them. It was crazy.
Yeah. There was a buying frenzy once you were getting your government dollars, your Biden bucks, like the whole thing just created like the perfect storm of people wanting to get these cards ready for when they're going to start playing with their friends again in person. And that was like the goal. That was the dream. You know, we want to get back to quote unquote as normal as we can. And I want to have these cards ready. I want to have this deck ready. And I have all the free time in the world to get it ready now. I don't have to have it done by next week because, you know, we're playing next week. I'm probably not playing for like 3 months. So I get to buy all the cards that I want for it. And then people did.
Do you find that you're able to predict market movements like that?
In my younger days, I was very good at doing that. In my card buying days now, I am less concerned with the market.
Yeah, it probably doesn't matter to you. You're not like specking. You're just buying no matter what.
Yeah, we buy everything. So when I was younger, I was a heavy speculator on certain cards that I thought were going to be good. And I was successful with some and I failed with others.
we all did.
But yeah, everybody did. But like I had some big hits. I had some big losses. But, you know, the price of the cards no longer concerns me, but there is a very large contingency of people that is very important to them to speculate on cards. It's conducive to their income and they treat them like stocks. Mm-hmm. Buy them cheap, sell them high.
Yeah. I mean like, cause the speculation market is such a weirder market because you have to like follow trends or you have to have inside knowledge or you have to have a friend that's on the PT and you're like, oh, they're going to break this deck. Not so much anymore, but it's like the way you used to do it. Like you would know, like they're going to break a deck. This is the deck they're on. So buy all the copies of Danger Time or something like that. And just,
yes.
Is it easy for someone to come into this market that might have like effectively unlimited funds and just, and really like manipulate things?
Yes. It's been done before. People will do what are called buyouts.
I've done a few buyouts in my day.
Yeah, I accidentally did a buyout a few months ago. Like it was totally by accident. I didn't even mean to do it, but I accidentally spiked a card. It's funny, but yes, if you have unlimited funds and say Black Lotuses are worth, you know, between $10,000 and $13,000 and you buy every single one on the internet and then you start very slowly releasing them for $15,000 or $16,000, like you're manipulating the market and people will, you know, a sucker's born every minute. So one or two people will buy them and it'll just keep continuing until the card is worth that much money.
Once that fear of missing out hits and all, then it hits the Reddit and the Twitter yep. and then everyone starts buying and they're going left and right. And it's just a frenzy.
Yeah. They start freaking out and, you know, yeah. Oh my God, this card is being bought out and I need to get my copy before it's $500, even though now it's $400. But before it was bought out, it was $200. So it's definitely, if you have the funds, you can certainly manipulate the market. I'm talking to you, Rudy.
I mean, a lot of like most buyouts, like you said, like you didn't intend to do it, but a lot of that happens because like people would like, oh, I need four of these for my EDH deck or something. And let me go buy them. There's only like five on TCG players. So then it starts dropping the stock. And other people see it and everyone just starts freaking out. And yeah, most buyouts are usually unintentional, but there is some amount of manipulation.
Yeah. And the people that have the cards, like say with Smothering Tide, for example, let's say there's 10 copies of it up and I have 10 EDH decks and I'm like, well, cool. I want to play Smothering Tide and all of my EDH decks. So I buy them all at $30. Well, there's a guy with 50 of them sitting in his box, like just sitting on his shelf. And he's like, cool. So he puts them all up for $45. And now people, that's the baseline price because, you know, there's no Smothering Tides on the internet anymore for $30. So now they're buying them at $45. And then sometimes the market settles and people just go, well, fuck that. I'm not buying them at $45. And then the guy has to take them off and put them down to be, you know, back to $40. People don't buy them. Now they're back down to $35. Okay, now they're back to normal price. But that isn't always the case. And sometimes there is absolutely mass manipulation on certain cards.
Especially if like a TCG model, I don't know how familiar you are with TCG, Seamus, but TCG is basically like kind of like an eBay-esque, like where people just put stuff online, they list it, and there's a finite number, like there's so many listings, and once they're gone, they're gone. Like people have to relist cards and so forth. And you can manipulate prices that way as well, because if you have one guy that has a card for $10,000 and you buy all the copies beneath it, now that card's worth $10,000 because it's the last one standing.
Yeah.
So, and then like, it creates like weird price structures.
It happens, but that's the same with any hobby like Yu-Gi-Oh, Pokemon, video games, sports cards, especially right now, how big they are. I mean, there's the market on those is obscene, but you'll have a guy like buying up as many LeBron 2003 Topps Chromes rookie cards as he can. And the card, you know, or what was his name? Lucas, like people, Luca rookie cards went from like $800 to like $6,000 because somebody was very smart and bought all the Lucas and they all of a sudden exploded in price. And people think it was a manipulation, but it was also had to do with a lot of his play during the regular season. And that, you know, you want to, it's the FOMO, it's the fear of missing out. So, but you can certainly manipulate markets, but it exists in every hobby. So there's not much, you know, Magic isn't unique or special in that regard.
Not at all. And it's actually kind of like lowball compared to like other markets. Like you said, like the sports card industry, like that's much bigger.
Sports cards are terrifying. Like you'll see 15-year-olds walking around with $30,000 in cards because they like specced on them. You know, like it's fucking crazy. Like there's nothing scarier than seeing a 15-year-old walk up to you with like a briefcase of like $70,000 worth of cards, and you're like, I could just kick your ass, man, and take these. like what are you gonna do? Tell your mom? Like, you know, it's funny to joke about it, but these kids have like retirement funds just sitting in a box and they're trading these 30, 20, 10, $15,000 cards with other, you know, grown ass men like that have less of a collection than they do. And they're getting sharked by like 15-year-olds. It's funny, but that hobby right now it's so explosive and so volatile that there's no real comparison to any other hobby right now.
Are you in the sports cards at all?
I got into it a little bit, but I got into it when the market started declining. See, I was like a novice. So I got into some cards that were cheap. I sold them back when they were a little bit higher because I was nervous. So I kind of got out of it already because the market was massive in like March through May. And then it started a pretty, not a steep decline, but it took a hit. It started going down. And I realized that like I got into it at the wrong time and I didn't want to tie up too much of my bankroll with, you know, if I'm buying a card for $500 and it goes up to $505, like what am I doing really? So I have some cards out to Beckett right now. They're getting graded and, you know, I'll probably make a few $1,000s of profit off those. But other than that, it's too scary for me to get involved in it right now.
You don't have enough experience for it, right?
No, not even close.
And you're buying Pokemon cards as well, or just sticking with like Magic?
We buy Pokemon, but we buy higher end Pokemon.
Okay, graded cards or
graded like cards? Yeah. Like even if they're not graded, but like you've got like a Shadowless Charizard, not like a first edition or you know, but if you have like a Shadowless Charizard, you know, we'll buy it off you. Or we bought a graded set of the big three, you know, Blastoise, Venusaur, and Charizard, all Shadowless, all graded. We don't buy like the $10 to $15 cards because try to stay away from the smaller potatoes, like when it comes to Pokemon, because that market is also very weird. And it was very driven by like the Paul brothers cracking first edition boxes and people were going nuts for it. And now the market has slowed down with that. it's, I wouldn't say it's volatile, but it's certainly a little bit more
unpredictable.
I would say unpredictable. And I want to stay with the high end because that always maintains the value. That always is something you can move properly. And it's just a lot less nerve wracking basically than tying your, you know, $5,000 up into a collection of cards that are all worth, you know, $10, $15, $20.
Yeah. But like for Magic cards, you would still buy like the $10 and $15 cards. You're not just buying like Underground Seas.
Yeah. Okay. Magic is a little bit different in that regard because EDH being as popular as it is for your viewers that don't know, it works out really well because those cards sell super, very, super quick because that format is so popular that it makes it very, very easy to move those cards. It, you know, you buy them for 10, you sell them for 14. And then you just put them on TCG Player and they sell instantaneously because they're commander staples.
Yeah. Is there any Magic cards you guys to stay away from?
Yeah, the banned stuff we stay away from, like your Invoke Prejudices, your Crusades, you know, things signed by Therese Nielsen, like we try to stay away from those. And because, you know, Noah Bradley stuff, like we try to, you know, like if I have a bunch of expeditions, like I'll sell them. But if they're signed by Noah Bradley, I'll move them to like a private buyer.
I didn't even think about sign cards because I'm so big in sign cards. It's so funny that there's like blacklisted now. Is that across all vendors or is that just your guys?
Like, I'll give you like a peek through the curtain. Like there was we just did a big show in Texas, in Galveston, Texas, TCG Con in Galveston, Texas. And we had a very large stack of very expensive cards that were signed by Therese Nielsen and Noah Bradley. And I went to one of the vendors and I was like, just be fair, you know, because I can't sell them to a normal player. They're not going to buy them or they would buy them, but it's bad for your reputation.
Yeah, they just don't know.
Since we're not like as mega as some of these other buyers, like the guy was like, sure. So he bought them for X amount of thousands of dollars and was like, yeah, but I'm gonna have to sell these. Like he bought them off me for like 50%. And he's like, I'm gonna have to sell these at like 70% because nobody is gonna buy them at 100% value. And he was right. So, I mean, it comes down to when you're selling like a $170 card for $80 because you have to, because that's what their signatures did to the value of their cards. Unless you're dealing with somebody that really likes Therese Nielsen and Noah Bradley, but
I really like her art, her politics and what she believes in. I can't say anything about, but her art is gorgeous. Noah Bradley can do without.
He's not a very good guy.
Yeah. I mean, Force of Will art is just so iconic. And it's just,
yeah. It's, I mean, whether or not you agree with them or not, it's, there's a group of people that do agree with them. There's a group of people that don't agree with them, but the people that don't agree with them that are going to be a lot louder about you selling those cards than the group that doesn't care.
It's not even worth it at that point. It's crazy. Yeah. Oh man.
So that's where you're kind of just like, it's better to shy away, keep your reputation intact and
not worth it.
Wash your hands and be safe.
Did you take a hit on any of those cards when when all that controversy broke?
Because Evoke Prejudice was Evokes were like a few hundred dollars to the reserve list and all before they got pseudo banned, I guess. So I'm sure there's a bunch of vendors that had a lot of Evokes on them.
Yeah, I mean the ones that really hurt were the Noah Bradleys and the Therese Nielsens. Like those really hurt.
Yeah, because they're high ends. Yeah, because Noah did all the expeditions and all. He did all the fetch lands or shock lands.
He did the shock land expeditions and. Like if I have non-signed ones, I sell them because at that point I'm just like, you know, it's not as personal, but you know, there was one guy that had a full set of like insane amounts of side Noah Bradley stuff before the base dropped. And we were like, sweet, like this is going to move so easy. And then the next week it was like the story broke about him. And for those of you that don't know, Noah Bradley was involved in like a pretty big sexual harassment force, like kind of like coercing women into having sex with him, like taking advantage of drunk girls.
Yeah, I'm a really famous artist. You should sleep with me.
If you're drunk, like come up to my room, I'll take care of you and like, you know, shit like that. And it broke. And all of a sudden those cards that we had, we were just like, we put in a box and it was in like, you know, they were in the box with the Therese Nielsen signed things, which we had like signed Guru Land, signed Force of Wills. Like we had everything that, you know, that these artists had done, all their iconic cards. And it went very poorly for us. So
what's the controversy around Therese Nielsen?
Am I allowed to talk about it?
Yeah, I don't care.
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, she basically just followed like really like really alt right? Were they alt right or alt left?
Yeah, she would alt right. She would like tweets by like QAnon people. You know, like there's fluoride in the water. There's microchips in your vaccines. Like she would like those, and she was liking posts from trans exclusatory radical feminists, and was not very kind to the trans community. And she sort of doubled down whenever she was called out on it. And was like, I'm a big supporter. I'm actually gay. Like, how can I be prejudiced if I'm gay? Is there some gray in this? Like, of course, there's some gray in every situation. But Wizards cut ties with her and Noah Bradley. And at that point, you're blacklisted. And it's like, I just stay away from your goodies and baddies, because at that point, I'm not going down that road.
Yeah, especially like, Therese has so many bangers as well. It's like, obviously, the two different Force of Wills.
Oh, Eternal Witness. Yeah.
The Lotus Cobra promo.
Yeah,
Guru Lands. I think Rhystic Study is where she did
Rhystic Study. I mean, yeah. it's devastating. And it's, I do not agree with her politics. I think she made beautiful art, but I'm one of those people, like, I cannot separate the art from the artist, because I will always tie in. You know, like when I was younger, one of my favorite bands was Lost Prophets. And if you guys know anything about Lost Prophets, like, please, you don't need to know anything about them. Just Google it. It's horrifying. But that was like one of my favorite bands growing up. And I connected with them so hard, and I loved their music, and it meant so much to me. And then a story about their lead singer broke, which, for those of you out there, just Google it. I won't talk about it, but, or am I allowed to talk about it?
Yeah.
I don't care.
I can edit it out. If it's too bad.
He was involved in child porn.
Jesus.
Yeah. And like trying to coerce one of his fans into like letting him like have Jesus his way with you know.
God damn it.
So obviously at that point, like I can't, there's no separation of that for me. There's no like, oh, well, you can't just, it's the artist, you know, it's the music that matters, not the man. And in my head, I'm like, if I listen to this song, like in the back of my head, I'm always going to be like, yeah, this guy. No,
it was like that for me for R. Kelly too, especially after I watched that documentary. It's like,
let's go back to your writing. I know we didn't really touch on that yet. So how'd you get into actually writing for Magic?
So it started a long time ago, to be honest. It started back in 2006. I tried to have an article published for a website called lawns.com, and the editor called me a fucking idiot. It was like, this is terrible, you fucking idiot. And I was like, that's excessive, man. I'm like this 20-year-old kid. I'm like, I want to write about Magic. This is going to be fun. It wasn't fun because he called me mean names. So I shied away from it for a while. And then in 2009, I won Florida regionals, and I got contacted by the guy that ran, I don't know if he still runs it, but ran TCG Player at the time. And he was like, hey man, like, do you want to write an article about your experience? And I was like, sure. So I wrote an article and it went over really, really well. And they offered me a position, but at the time I was a little too busy with being addicted to World of Warcraft. So I declined. And then a few years later in 2012, I won Florida States, and they contacted me again, and they were like, hey man, do you want to write about winning states? And I was like, sure. So I wrote about it, and the article went over super well. And they were like, do you want to go full time with this? I said, sure. So I went full time writing for TCG Player, just writing pretty cookie cutter articles about decks that were good and trying to be funny, but like trying to take it really seriously, because I was like, oh, this is my shot. Like, this is big. This is so big. Eventually was approached by Star City Games, and they were like, I don't want to say they were like, you're being wasted over there, but you know, kind of. So I went over to Star City Games. I started writing articles for them. They kind of like took the cuffs off me and were like, have fun, like do what you want. In 2015, I started this Why Your Deck Sucks, which was a spinoff of Why Your Team Sucks, whatever edition, 2015 edition, which was done by, I believe it was Drew Madry. That's it. And I just made fun of people's decks. Like, I just made fun of decks and cards. And I thought it was really funny, and a lot of people thought it was really funny, and a lot of people didn't think it was really funny. So I had the highest metrics of any writer on SCG at the time, because like my articles would get like 150 comments on them. It would be like, people like, this guy sucks, why do you pay him? he should kill
death threats.
You know, so I remember I got one guy, he messaged me, he's like, if I see you at the next GP, man, like, you're dead. And I was like, cool. Like, my first death threat. You know, I had people like threaten to like assault me, murder
me. They threaten to kill your cats and shit like that as well.
Yeah, I had somebody that was like, I'll show up to your house and I'll skin your cats. I had some things I can't say on the on the air for people threatening me. And I, at that point, like, I'm committed. Like, I'm like, oh my God, this gets such a great reaction. So SCG was like, no, we want more of this. Like, we want like this, the analytics on this are stupid. So I started writing more of it, and I started getting more and more like antagonistic with my tone, and it took off, and it was like my bread and butter for a few years. And it was so much fun because I got to piss off so many nerds and just write about why their favorite deck sucked, why their pet deck sucked, why their cards that they like sucked. And it was all done like tongue in cheek. Like, I played some of the decks that I wrote about, like, they were good at the time, but it was just funny because like for a good 4 years of my life, I was constantly getting people saying like, you suck, you should kill yourself. Like, SCG should fire you. No wonder this is on the free side. And they would never move me. They would never move me over to the paid side because I was getting so many views on the free side that like, it was just, people weren't going to pay for it. A, because it wasn't like, you know, insane content, but like, I was getting them so many clicks that like, they would be stupid to move me to the paid side. So I just kept doing it for years and antagonizing more and more nerds. It was the most fun I've ever had writing in my life.
So what happened? Why did you end up leaving?
My wife found out she was pregnant.
Okay.
And I was like, well, I was one of those travelers. Like, I was on a team at the time, Team Nexus. And we were traveling around the country to play Magic. And I was going to big tournaments, Grand Prix and everything like that. And I just knew that with my son coming and her needing me, obviously, for the next, you know, year of our lives, that it would not behoove me to be leaving her alone. So I quietly left Magic, and I came back about a year and a half later and started writing again, wrote for about 3 more years. I wrote for Star City Games. Then I went back to TCG Player, wrote for them. That was it. I stopped about a year ago and I haven't really looked back.
You miss it?
I miss the people telling me to kill myself.
I'm sure you can still get those.
You can get that on Twitter pretty easily.
Yeah, I'm very well liked on Twitter, so I don't get any of those. I get a lot of like nice people, which is badass. But I do miss it in regards to like, they gave me a really really nice creative outlet and they let me do whatever I wanted. Like, people used to say like, oh, SCG only has articles to sell cards, and like, that just wasn't true. Like, you know, Cedric Phillips was like, Mark, take the ball, run with it, like, do whatever you want, have fun. And I did. So
what, when you're writing those articles, were you just trying to think, oh, this is gonna piss someone off if I write this? Like, what, yes. Was that like how you're going into it? It's just like, yes. Yeah, okay.
That's, yes, awesome. Like, I like, and what was good is like, I would write like one or two normal articles, like about a deck that was good or how I did at a tournament and why you should play the deck or why you shouldn't play the deck. And then I would write like two articles about why your deck sucks. Like, so people, I just faked them out too much. Like, every week you didn't know what you were gonna get from me. And so people read the articles just to see like if I was going to be a prick or if I was going to be like an honest, like, you know, informative Magic player. So it was just funny because like every week was something like they had, you know, a box of chocolates. Like, you never knew what you were going to get. So I got to have a lot of fun with it. And and every time I wrote a Wire Deck Sucks or anything along those lines, I wrote it 100% with the intention of pissing people off.
And you were, I mean, you said a lot of the decks you wrote about were decks that you played. So you were just, mm-hmm. You were just kind of like highlighting the weaknesses in a hyperbolic way, right?
Weaknesses, cards that were too good. Basically like just the strategy of the deck, be like everything. Like I would pick the deck apart. I would dissect it in all its pieces and talk about why they were terrible and why the people, and I would go right after the players that played them too. Like I would talk about like how bad they were at Magic if they played it, or like how easy mode the deck was, or, you know, like how many brain cells can you kill playing this deck in a single tournament. Like, you know, I played one of the decks in a tournament and I had a brain cell kill count, like after every round, like how many brain cells I had killed, like the equivalent of how many beers I had drank or whatever. And it was just funny because it struck such a nerve, and it was the most fun thing, because every Monday or Friday, whenever my article would go up, I would wake up and I would be like, woo, we're going to town, boys. And it would be like 90 comments and just, is this guy serious? Fuck it. Cause people thought I was serious too. Like people didn't understand that like it was a joke. So like your 10-20% of people were like, this fucking guy, if I get a chance, like he's dead, man. Like I'm going to get him, you know, I'm going to burn his house to the ground. Like it was just so much fun. It was like the Wild West, you know.
Were you ever actually fearful of any of these threats?
There was one guy that at a GP that I was going to was like, I'll be there, man. I'll see you there. And I was like, okay. Like I didn't care. So like, I actually was there. I saw him and I was like, hey, I heard, you know, I thought you were going to do something. He was like, fuck you, man. And just like walked away. And I was like, okay, Billy Badass, like, you know, you're like, yeah, that was the only time that I had ever been in a room with somebody that had like actually threatened me. And like, they just didn't do anything about it. But it was funny. I never was fearful. Like if I was, I wouldn't have continued writing the articles, but yeah. Magic players are, you know,
we're traveling at least.
Yeah. They're a lot of pussy ass bitches. So
keyboard cowboys.
Yeah, exactly. Like what did that one guy say? Underground dojo keyboard fighters. Like, you know, there's a sect of Magic players I would never fuck with. Like I would never fuck with Todd Anderson. Like he would knock me out in 2 seconds. He would butterbean my ass. Like, you know, yeah, there'd be no
Todd's such a sweetheart though. So
he is, he's so nice. I love the guy, but like, there are certain Magic players like I would never fuck with, but like the normal person was like, I'm going to get you, man. Like I was like, okay, like, see you at the next event.
I'll be at table 24.
Yeah. You know, I would tweet where I'm at. Like, you know, I'm over here playing EDH.
I'd love to be your first fight.
Yeah. Yeehaw. See you there, bud. So yeah, I never worried about it. I just had fun with it.
And from like an article perspective, did you get paid based on clicks of your links? Like how many, like how is like that? I mean, you don't have to go into financial details, but right. how's that like normally done? Is really like pay for an article?
I was paid per article a set okay. pace, but I was also given a lot of raises by SCG.
Okay.
Yeah. They definitely rewarded the popularity of the article series by ensuring that I was very well compensated for each article.
Oh, that's awesome. Yeah. Now, I'm sure this is really cutthroat now because like everyone wants to be like a writer. I mean, is like, would you be able to get back into it? You think if you wanted to, like, would they give you like the opportunity? Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I had a preview card that I got to do a few months ago.
That I didn't realize you got a preview card. It's awesome.
Well, there's a story behind it.
Okay.
One of the famous personalities from the earlier days of Twitch, Noxious, who is relatively well known through A, Twitter, and B, through the gaming community. He was like, Mark, listen, I got this card. Like, do you want to ghostwrite the article? And I was like, yes. So he emailed the department about the card, was like, hey, I got this guy. Like, he's written for SCG, he's written for TCG player. Like, I'd love it if he could ghostwrite the article and like get credit for it. Like, you know, I'll be the guy that presents the card, but I want him to write the article. And at the time, I was writing MTG smut, like on Twitter. I was writing like, because Wizards of the Coast, like they had made some stupid decisions with like the sexuality of some characters. So I started writing about like Ugin and Nicol Bolas having sex with each other. Like, you know, like just started going like stupid on it. Like, and I started telling people like, you could pay me and I'll write these. And like some very famous Magic personalities, like very famous started like Wizards employees. Started paying me money to write these smutty stories. So like they didn't realize that, I guess, that it was like, that's what I was, one of the things that I had been doing. So they let me write it. And then I wrote the article. It got published on Channel Fireball, which that means I got the hat trick. Like I had TCG, SCG and Channel Fireball articles, but they added me to the content creator program because of that. And I had to email them. And my email literally said, you've made a horrifying mistake. I'm the guy that made the incest porn between Ugin and Nicol Bolas. Like, please remove you from this program right now. You do not want me representing you. And they were like, okay, yeah, you are that guy. I guess it somehow got past our team. And I was like, it's pretty bad.
What was the card?
It was Essica, God of the Tree.
Okay.
Yeah. So it was her. And then the Planar Bridge was the other side. Yeah. Or the Prismatic Bridge, sorry.
Did you write the article for EDH? Because I know it's an EDH card, right?
I wrote it from the I was had to be antagonistic about it too. So like I wrote it from the perspective of like a Wizards intern trying to pitch this card, like to Wizard executives, like to their department. It was I was like cackling while I was writing it because I was like, I want Wizards employees to read this and to like be pissed off. I got a really good response from them, I guess. So that's why they added me to the creator program. But it was a really cool thing to do. And I thank Noxious for giving me that opportunity because it was a lot of fun. So
yeah, that's really cool. Yeah. All right. We won't keep you much longer, Mark. I know you've been on with us for a while. A couple of lightning round questions. What's your favorite EDH deck?
Mizzix of the Ismagus.
Why? Just goofy dumb spells?
I play big ass spells in the deck. Yeah. So, I mean, I can get them cheaper with his ability to make instants and sorceries cheaper. And I just get to play really, really big spells. Crackle with Power to Table for 2000. So that was cool. Everybody died except me.
What's your favorite deck you've ever played at like a competitive level?
Probably Solar Flare. Okay. Back in 2011 and 12, I had a ton of success with that deck. I top aided like 5 PTQs with it. I almost won estates with it. I had a great time with the deck. It was really intricate and fun, and I loved it.
If you could ban any card in any format, what card would it be?
Cyclonic Rift in EDH. Yeah.
Fuck that Everyone card. Says Cyclonic Rift.
Fuck that card. Fuck it.
Were you pro or anti for Hull Breacher?
I was happy that it was banned because it meant less wheels would be played, and that leads to less people making so you don't have a hand anymore and can't play the game. And I hated Hull Breacher.
Favorite Planeswalker?
That's a good question. What was his name? The 5-mana Sarkin that can turn into a dragon.
From Cons,
yeah.
Yeah. Oh shit.
Sarkin the Dragon Speaker, I think, or something like that. Or,
yeah, something like that. Yeah.
I won my first PTQ with him in my deck. So that was
Standard like, All-Star, yeah.
Yeah, that was my guy right there.
Who would you play at that PT?
The PT for that I played Abzan Control with Splashing Red for Atarka. Dragon Lord Atarka.
If you can unban any card, what would it be? Any format?
Oh, Jesus, Mary. It would probably be EDH, and it would be Coalition Victory. I think that's a really fun card, and it's like you have to do so much to get it to work.
It's so underpowered.
One counter spell, it's gone, and it's like it's just. I think it's a really cool card that never really got its time to shine.
Favorite set?
Onslaught.
Onslaught. Okay, yeah. That's actually one of my favorites. That's awesome.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Favorite pro player?
Jerry T.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, I love Jerry.
Really nice guy.
Mark, it's been awesome having you on the podcast tonight and hanging out with us.
Yeah, man, it was good. It's good talking to you.
Thank you. It was awesome being here.
Where can our listeners find more of you, your Twitter, all that kind of stuff, to buy some sweet cards?
You can find me on Dynamo Nestico on Twitter. I'm selling card sucks on there. So if you just type in Dynamo Nestico, you can find me. If you're into buying Magic the Gathering cards or retro video games, hit me up and I can see what I can do for you. But that's pretty much it. I don't use Facebook anymore because it's a cesspool and... Instagram is too trendy for me. I'm not cool enough to use it.
No TikTok?
I don't even know what the fuck a TikTok is.
I don't know. People keep telling me I do TikTok. I have no idea what it is.
Yeah, I've watched a few of them and I'm like, this is stupid and very cringy. So I just stay away from TikTok.
Mark, have a great night, buddy. I really appreciate it.
Thank you guys very much. Yeah, man.
Thanks a lot.
Have an awesome night. Cheers.
We didn't nerd out too much on you, did we?
No. I'm right there with you.
I know that sometimes the comic book stuff you kind of like glaze over.
Yeah, I don't really have much skin in the game with that, but I get the Magic stuff.
Really? More than the comic stuff? I figured, I mean, you've been out of Magic for so long.
Well, no, it's just it's like there's a strategy element to it, so it's more interesting to me. I like comics. It's a lot more about like things I like. It's about ideas or about like cognition. So like in comics, there's a lot of different ideas, right? There's a lot more ideas that can be like kind of explored rather than like maybe through television or something else, because there's more there, you know. So I like it from that perspective. You know, it's I think it's a lot less costly to explore like a novel idea in a comic than it is to have a television show or something else.
Yeah, because even like with like comics and like stuff like that, you need like such an investment to really understand. But like Magic, you can stop playing Magic for like 10 years and you still understand like the premise of it. You still understand like the gist of it. But if you don't read comics or you just have like no idea about like a certain storyline, it's just like.
But the thing is with Magic, like I love Magic. I still love playing Magic. Thank you all for listening. If you would like to support the WWSD podcast, check out our Patreon at patreon.com/WWSD_podcast. Make sure you like and subscribe on our Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter.
Am I allowed to swear?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I don't think we're anti hate speech. So if you don't go on like a racist rant, we prefer that.
I don't like you always bring that up. But I feel like that's something that doesn't need to be said. You know what I mean?
You'd be surprised that one time we don't say it, though.
Somebody who often like engages in hate speech, I don't think that they really consider that to be hate speech. You know what I mean? It's like
that's normal speech.
This is how I talk. That's how I talk. I'm from the South. That's how I talk.
Yeehaw.